Name something that gets passed around.
A joint.
A joint.
Now, streaming live on the Marijuana Agenda.
Oh, gnarly. What are you people? On dope?
It's time for Toker Talk Radio.
Hey, this is great, man.
The voice of the marijuana nation.
Marijuana is listed as a Schedule I drug. That is absurd.
Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ. That's 650-534-2565.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Hey, man. Am I driving okay?
Toker Talk Radio is your chance to make your voice heard in the marijuana nation.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to Enema Man and Snoopy Poop Dog.
Send that message with clarity that good people don't smoke marijuana.
Now let's get to Toking and Talking with your host, Russ Belville.
Welcome back, everybody. It's a 4 o'clock hour here in beautiful legal potland. And if you're watching live on MJAgenda.com, hey, we do have a live phone number, 650-LEGAL-MJ. That's 650-534-2565. And even if we're not on the air, if you're watching this as a YouTube, if you're watching or listening to this as a podcast, you can still call because it's got a message line. And you call in and we can take your message and use it on air, perhaps. And if you do call, do understand that you are giving your permission to be aired on the air and recorded for posterity. So going back to what we were talking about in the rant there before I was rudely interrupted by a misprogrammed automator, there is this law, this U.S. code that provides for a death penalty for kingpins in a drug trafficking organization. It also provides, the second part of that, provides for a death penalty for ordering a hit against a witness or a juror in a RICO case. Not that the hit was successful. That already is a first-degree murder thing, right? But ordering a hit and then it doesn't actually kill the guy, that'll probably also be found unconstitutional because it's not a first-degree homicide. In that 2008 case, Kennedy, what was it? What was the case? Kennedy versus Louisiana, the child rape case. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, established a standard that Justice Kennedy said, on the one hand, you got murder, first degree murder. And on the other hand, you got everything else. Even child rape. You can't use capital punishment for anything like that. Now, that's interesting to me because I understand in the Constitution, we do have a death penalty prescribed for treason. So, you know, how would that shake out if there was a constitutional challenge on that? See, I don't want to rest assured that we're going to be safe in this issue when it comes to the death penalty for drug traffickers. That's already on the law's already on the books. That if it were challenged, would necessarily be found unconstitutional. I think this court, especially with Neil Gorsuch on it, is going to be changing a lot of the precedents that we've had. And coming up in the second segment today, I'm going to get you into detail. We're going to go into the weeds in the Supreme Court in the bottom half of this hour on a recent case that had to do with the Eighth Amendment that a circuit court went against a couple other courts and their precedent, and the Supreme Court with Gorsuch agreed and with just a tortured reading of the law. And it's kind of nitpicky. We're going to get into some English language here. Call your high school English teacher because we're going to get deep into the infinitival phrases of this decision. But I'm not so secure in the idea that if there were a challenge to whether or not it had to be a capital crime for there to be a death penalty, that this court, as construed, would follow precedent. Because what would you have to do? Well, if the idea is that there has to be intentional malice aforethought to kill people, you'd have to make the case somehow that as a drug dealer, as someone involved in a continuing criminal enterprise, as a kingpin of a cartel or a grow business, you were knowingly engaged in some sort of activity that any reasonable person would understand would lead to the death of people. And in this case, lots of people. You'd have to make a case that, look, this is worse than a first degree murder. This is worse than just killing someone, right? This is going out there and killing tens of people or dozens or scores or hundreds and hundreds of people.
So we're going to very much, you know, as you know, we've been involved more than any administration by far. It's a problem that's growing. And drugs are a similar but different problem in the sense that we have pushers and we have drug dealers that don't, I mean, they kill hundreds and hundreds of people, and most of them don't even go to jail. You know, if you shoot one person, they give you life, they give you the death penalty. These people can kill 2,000, 3,000 people, and nothing happens to them. And we need strength with respect to the pushers and to the drug dealers. And if we don't do that, you're never going to solve the problem. If you want to be weak and you want to talk about just blue ribbon committees, that's not the answer. The answer is you have to have strength and you have to have toughness. The drug dealers, the drug pushers they're really doing damage. They're really doing damage. Some countries have a very, very tough penalty, the ultimate penalty. And by the way, they have much less of a drug problem than we do. So we're going to have to be very strong on penalties.
That sound like maybe an argument for it should be a precedent that would pass that Kennedy versus Louisiana standard that it leads to the homicide of hundreds and hundreds or thousands and thousands of people. Is that reason enough to give someone death penalty? Is that constitutional under the Eighth Amendment? Interesting how the Eighth Amendment's going to play into today's second hour. And I don't know. Given what Gorsuch decided in this case that we talk about at the bottom half hour, I don't see him as being a big defender of the Eighth Amendment. So now I do get pushback on this from some of my listeners. They're like, man, legalization is never going away. It's always going to be legal. It's so big. There's so much money involved. They're not going to really do anything. They can't go against it. The cat's out of the bag, blah, blah, blah. And you know, I will cede that. You may be absolutely right. You may be absolutely right. It's hard to make the case that someone involved in marijuana, you know, legal dispensary business, is leading to the deaths of thousands and thousands of people. Unless you want to tie it together with that tenuous thread of, you know, the gateway theory that's leading to the eventual deaths of people because of it being a gateway drug. That might be one of the ways to do it.
A DEA said that a huge percentage of the heroin addiction starts with prescriptions. That may be an exaggerated number. They had it as high as 80%. We think a lot of this is starting with marijuana and other drugs, too.
Yeah, maybe you could make that. I will cede that point. I will say, look, marijuana's fine. Legal marijuana's fine. They can slow it down, maybe, but they can't hope to contain it, right? They're the Calvin Johnson of... that was an old reference. I should pick a better wide receiver. Anyway, you can only hope to slow them down. You can't contain them. The LeBron James. Marijuana legalization is the LeBron James of policy. You can only hope to slow them down. I'll concede that. But I want people to think that, you know, of that old Niemöller poem. First they came for the trade unionists, but I wasn't a trade unionist, so I said nothing. Then they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I said nothing. Then they came for everything, but then when they came for me, there was no one left to speak up, right? And sometimes I think in the marijuana movement, we've got this tendency to be insular about, hey, we've got our herb and it's non-toxic and it's helpful and healing, and kind of have a disdain for the other drugs. If this Trump administration starts cracking down on heroin and coke and meth and throwing people away, you know, locking them away and throwing away the key and destroying people's lives over it, I hope the people in the marijuana movement don't just turn a blind eye to that and understand that an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Dr. King said. We'll get more into that. Also, coming up next, a little history lesson on how marijuana prohibition brought us President George W. Bush. If marijuana was legal, we'd have had a President Gore and probably not a President Trump. History coming up next.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
No, Nelson, that's illegal. I can smoke this because I have cancer.
Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson for Norman. And I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
The Marijuana Agenda free podcast is available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, SoundCloud, and on our Facebook page at MJ Agenda. Free video archives are available at the Radical Russ channel on YouTube. Help keep this media free by making a donation at paypal.me/Radical Russ. Pot 2.0.
It's not your father's Woodstock weed.
It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
Welcome back, everyone. 12 after the hour. And, you know, I don't think it's really going to happen. I don't think there's going to be anyone executed for being a drug kingpin. The political blowback, too great. It's just, but you know, it's also like, I don't think there's going to be a nuclear war. I really don't. I don't think there's going to be a nuclear war. I think everybody knows that that's a, you know, the end of civilization event, and nobody wants it, right? So I don't think there's going to be a nuclear war. But how much I didn't think there was going to be a nuclear war is a number that has increased. That has decreased, I should say, since Trump has come into office, right? It's like, if I thought before that the chance of a nuclear war was 1 in 10,000, well, under Trump, I think it's like 1 in 5,000 now, right? It's like, it's still a little tiny number, but it's not as tiny as it used to be. And so that's how I feel about this, you know, execution of drug dealers. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'm not as sure as I used to be. Okay, and I bring up these nightmare scenarios partially just because it's entertaining, but also to get people to thinking, all right, maybe Russ is over the top on that, but there's something to this, and we should take a look at maybe these smaller things that are going on that we can have some effect on. And so in that vein, I want to start kind of educating folks on political awareness, on understanding the gravitas of the situation when it comes to an election, when it comes to a vote, and how important it is. And so we're going to go back, we're getting a way back machine here, to 2000, to tell the tale of how marijuana prohibition created George W. Bush. And I would posit that there's this arc in the Republican Party, right? You start with, like, you know, going way back, your Republicans were, you know, smart intellectual types, you know, William F. Buckley and all, right? But then you get to Nixon, and Nixon was a smart guy, smart and, you know, politically astute, and had his history going through the House of Reps and everything like that, right? So you got your Nixon, right? But then think of the Republicans from that point on. You go from Nixon to Reagan. Now Reagan was a politician. He'd been governor of California, but he was also the guy who was in Bedtime for Bonzo. right? He was a B movie actor, right? And it kind of opened up this possibility, like, what we can, you know, people don't necessarily have to be super serious. They could have been B movie actors with chimpanzees. That's okay. We can have someone like that in the Oval Office. And so the door was open, just a little crack. Now, following Reagan, you had H.W. Bush in the mold of your standard president type, right? You know, longtime government guy, military vet, you know, stick up his ass, right? Standard issue president. So there's a little blip there. But remember, he was Reagan's vice president, kind of slipped in on Reagan's coattails. So you get to your next major president in the Republican Party, it's George W. Bush. Now the door's cracked open a little more. The suspicions of draft dodging, had admitted to using cocaine, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. To this day, the second dumbest governor of Texas, right? Like, weird, right? But the door was open a little more as to who would be allowed to be president. Now, Bush had a terrible presidency, and we come into 2008, and Barack Obama upsets the apple cart with Hillary Clinton and gets the nomination. And to oppose him, he's got John McCain. Standard issue, right? Longtime politician, you know, super serious on all the Sunday shows, was a POW, war hero, you know, military vet. Standard issue, right? And standard issue, Republican, is losing to a black guy named Hussein, right? It's driving the Republicans crazy. So what do? The door had already been opened. Hey, we had a little success with that actor guy. We had a little more success with that, you know, dumb guy from Texas. Let's go with an idiot governor from Alaska. Let's go with Sarah Palin, right? Now, rewind back to the Nixon years. Imagine trying to put a Sarah Palin up in any sort of Republican primary or present her as somebody to take seriously in government. Wouldn't have been just impossible to imagine, but the door since Reagan had just been open and you know, kicked open, and you know, had, you know, Schwarzenegger becoming governor of California, for God's sake, put that on the list, right? So you get to Palin. Shit, Palin can be vice president. That woman's an idiot. Anybody can be in now, all right? And that, of course, leads us to where we're at now. We get Donald Trump, Donald freaking Trump, and of course, Donald Trump. Cast in a lot of that has to do with the backlash, right? The backlash to the black president, the latent racism that America was founded on, coming to rear its ugly head, and he taps into that as well. So if you hadn't had a George W. Bush, that arc of Republicans getting stupider and stupider and more outrageous would have been nipped, right? We'd have gone from two terms of Clinton to a term of Gore, at least one term of Gore, maybe two terms of Gore. With two terms of Gore, we don't ignore briefings about bin Laden determined to attack the United States, and maybe we get, you know, prevent 9/11. If that doesn't happen, we don't get embroiled into two Middle Eastern wars. And Gore being serious, you know, being all about Mr. Climate Change, maybe we start doing something about climate change. And also all that war money, we got that trillions of dollars, maybe we spend it on infrastructure. With such a continuing success of economy and public policy, four straight Democratic terms, maybe it continues. Maybe the Democrats become a strong force. Left-wing politics becomes the norm in America, and that's followed by another term and another term. And it never gets around to Obama being the president, or if Obama is the president, there's not the backlash to him that there would have been before, and we never end up with Donald Trump. If only Al Gore, the winner of the popular vote in 2000. And there also we set a precedent of the winner of the popular vote not becoming the president. Although we know it's in the Electoral College, it's in the way our Constitution's written, it needs to be abolished. But we know that's the rules, right? We accept a 500,000 popular vote loser as president. That preps us for 2016 when someone who loses by 3 million popular votes gets to be the president. If George W. Bush's presidency never happens, if it had been Al Gore's presidency, how much different would this country be? And it all comes down to the fact that marijuana was illegal. If marijuana had been legal, Gore would have been president.
It's a mystery. It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma.
No, it's not. I'll unwrap this mystery when we come back from break. How would legal marijuana have prevented a President George W. Bush? I'll tell you all about it after our anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
The Marijuana Agenda is a listener-supported independent podcast brought to you by Radical Russ Media, LLC. Subscribe to our VIP feed at mjagenda.com for access to our ad-free podcast segment archive. Make a one-time donation to support the Marijuana Agenda at paypal.me/radicalruss. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I smell pot coming from over here and grilled onions from over there. Two of my favorite smells ever.
Learn more at mjagenda.com.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
Mom, Dad,
we're pretty close, right?
Guess what? I'm 2 seconds away from kicking you out of my life.
You don't even recognize me.
And pretty soon,
someone's gonna try to get me to take drugs.
Wanna do something about it? You're gonna have to make me tell you where I am.
And who I'm with. Every day.
No matter how much I fight you.
Don't like it?
Tough.
You gotta be the grown-up.
This has been an actual anti-drug public service announcement. To combat this and other drug war hysteria, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific at live.mjagenda.com or download the free podcast at mjagenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
We need to say, as Nancy Reagan said, just say no. Don't do it. There's no excuse for this.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Hello, Mr. Man. Hi. I'm working. I'm sorry. No food till this is done.
It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
So if marijuana were legal in 2000, Al Gore would have been president. Had he been president, Bush wouldn't have been president. If Bush hadn't been president, we'd have not ended up with Trump. That's my theory. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that the Supreme Court had their Bush v. Gore decision, that awarded the loser of the popular vote. Remember, he lost. George W. Bush lost the popular vote. Supreme Court 5-4 decision, partisan lines, awarded him the presidency when they halted the recount in Florida. And we're not going to go into the hanging chads and the dimpled chads and, you know, all of that that went on, the Brooks Brothers riot. There was a lot of shenanigans going on. Bush's brother Jeb was the Jeb. Please clap. Bush's brother Jeb was the governor there when this all happened, and Bush's campaign chair was the secretary of state there. There was a lot of shenanigans going on, but it never should have been that close. Never should have been that close. If marijuana had been legal in Florida, Vice President Al Gore would have won Florida, and then he would have easily won the Electoral College, and there would never would have been a Bush v. Gore decision. Now, the reasoning for this, let me break it down. Let me show you my work, okay? Florida has one of the nation's most draconian penalties for marijuana possession. It takes only 21 grams. That's just about 3/4 of an ounce. 21 grams to trigger felony possession penalties in the state of Florida. Felonies. Now, when you get a felony in the state of Florida, you lose your right to vote. Not just your prison time and your parole time and your probation time. You don't get to vote while you're in prison on parole or probation. And a lot of states have that. But in Florida, a felon then has to wait 5 years after the completely clear papers, right, as they call it. You're completely off papers. You've served all your time. You paid your debt to society. Then you got to wait 5 years to apply, to beg an executive committee, can I please have my right to vote back, please? And they're under no pressure to approve this. In fact, they rarely do. And the thing is all subject to a veto by the governor, even if they do grant the right to vote back. So there's such a backlog in the request just to get on the in front of the committee, such a backlog. And there's so few that they're actually granted their right to vote back that essentially in Florida, if you're a felon, you've lost your right to vote for life. And there's only two other states that do this, Iowa and Kentucky. Three states that have similar permanent lifetime disenfranchisement for felons. Now, this has been challenged. A few months before the 2000 election, like the September of 2000, there was a lawsuit that was filed, Johnson versus Bush. And it was arguing against Jeb Bush, right? Jeb! It argued that Florida's felon voting ban was unconstitutional. You can't do this because it's, you know, violates the 14th and 15th Amendment. And it took 5 years to wind through the courts. And in 2005, 11th Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the ban as constitutional. And the Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case. So the law as it stands is that, yes, you can bar people for life. So in 2007, former Florida governor, Charlie Crist, he was a Republican at the time. He since switched parties to Democrat. But back in 2007, he did some reform on these rules a little bit. He made it so there is an automatic restoration of voting rights after you completed your probation, parole, and prison sentence for certain felonies, like nonviolent felonies, right? And then just because of that, after a year, over 115,000 felons had their right to vote restored. This 2007, you remember, I'm just giving you kind of a background on Florida here, because in 2011, Governor Rick Scott not only reversed those reforms, he made it even stricter. He made it even tougher for felons who've completed all their sentence to get their right to vote back. He ensured that even the nonviolent felons had to go through the 5-year waiting period. And get this, while you're in this 5-year waiting period, any misdemeanor arrest restarts the clock. Even if they don't file charges, right? Even if you're not ever taken to court, they drop the charges. A mere misdemeanor arrest restarts that 5-year clock. Now, who is most likely to get pulled over for driving while black and get arrested for some trumped up charge? Exactly. Lifetime right to vote ban. So this ban could be on its last legs. In February, a district court ruled that Florida's standards are unconstitutional under the First and 14th Amendment. We don't know yet what's going to happen under appeal. But there is another route. In November, the voters of Florida might just render the whole thing moot because they are voting on a constitutional amendment in Florida to automatically restore voting rights to felons who have completed their sentences. Now, there are people for this and people against this, and typically the people that are for it lean Democratic and the people who are against it lean Republican. Because we know certain things about the demographics of people that have felonies. Now, if you go rewind back to 2000, the election of 2000, we had Vice President Gore following up on two terms of Clinton with a budget surplus for the first time in a long time, in a generation, best economy in the generation. Al Gore, a lion of the Senate, a statesman, losing to the second dumbest governor in Texas history, George W. Bush, where Jeb is the governor of Florida and he loses by 537. So why this is a big deal is because studies have shown that most former felons tend to support Democrats. Now, only about a third of them register to vote and only about a fifth actually vote, but still, when 2007, when Governor Crist had 115,000 felons get their votes back, a fifth of that, what are we talking, 23,000 people, 23,000 votes that are going to be overwhelmingly Democratic? And why? Well, because a substantial reason why is because a lot of the former felons are going to be black. One in three African-American males has a felony record in this country. Almost half of the people who've lost their right to vote from a felony, almost half of them in the whole country live in Florida. Now, if we get those people their right to vote back, well, in 2000, according to the polls, according to the exit polls, 9 out of 10 African-Americans voted for Al Gore. Now, clearly, the population of former felons in Florida who would likely have voted for Al Gore if they hadn't gotten a felony is going to be more than 537 votes. That would have won Florida for Al Gore. But that's all felons. How many felons would have been affected by legalized marijuana? Would legalized marijuana itself be enough to make a dent in the totals and be enough to elect Al Gore? Well, let's look at some numbers. In 2000, there were 116,912 drug arrests in Florida. Drug arrests. I don't know how many of those are for marijuana, but nationally, about half of all drug arrests are for marijuana. So let's just spitball a number. 58,000 marijuana arrests in Florida. Now, most of those arrests are going to be for below 21 gram amounts in Florida, the misdemeanor amounts. We don't know how many that would be. I can't find the numbers on that. So if we presume that legalization would have probably been legal at an ounce and it's a misdemeanor at 21 grams, right? Anybody that got that felony between 21 and 28 grams would have been saved a felony record. Now, how many people would that be? Well, I don't know. I mean, some of the people won't be black, and their votes might divide evenly between Republican or Democrat. Some of them would have been busted after the election, right? November and December, right? So we don't really have firm numbers here, but knowing that black people are about four times more likely to be busted for weed and 90% more likely to vote Democratic, it seems to me that legal weed would have allowed Al Gore to be elected. I mean, I only need 0.46% of Florida's 2,000 drug arrests to be black Democratic voters caught with 21 to 28 grams. That's all I need. I need this tiny, tiny sliver. And that's just presuming legal weed starts in Florida in the year 2000, right? If it had been legal earlier than that, well, then all those people who would have collected felony records for 21 to 28 grams of weed wouldn't have had felony records, and some of them would have voted, and a lot of them would have voted Democratic. I mean, this is the undeniable, it's undeniable that the war on drugs is meant to suppress black voters, meant to suppress left-leaning voters. This isn't a theory. They said as much. They came out and admit it. Dan Baum, back in 2006, interviewed John Ehrlichman. He interviewed him in 94 and wrote about it in 2006. He interviewed John Ehrlichman in 1994. John Ehrlichman was one of the senior guys with the Nixon White House. And they asked him about this war on drugs. Why'd you do this war on drugs? Why have this drug policy? Why are you going after marijuana? And Ehrlichman turns to him and says, quote, "You want to know what this was really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." End quote. And that's the birth of the drug war in this, in our modern times. 1969, 1970, Richard Nixon, and an obvious attempt to subvert left-wing movements that were against the Vietnam War, black power movements that were pushing civil rights boundaries. And it continues to this day. Now, though, marijuana felonization in some of these interior states is a method of suppressing votes of certain people, of making sure certain people have a record, of making sure there's an easy way to claim we smell something and then be able to violate their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. All right, stay tuned. When we come back, we got part two of my interview with Jehan Marku from Americans for Safe Access.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
You're a neo-maxi-zoom dweeby.
Learn more at mjagenda.com.
Hi, my name is Ricky Williams.
My name is Evan Britton.
My name is Mark Rustelli.
My name is Boo Williams.
My name is Jim McMahon.
My name is Chris Cluey.
My name is Kyle Turley. I played in one of the major North American football leagues.
I have two championship rings from that big game we play at the end of the season.
In college, I won a trophy that looks like this.
I was a punter for 8 seasons, and punters are football players too.
I also wrote the name of the commissioner on my headband, and everyone lost their shit.
The men who play American football are subject to a life of injury,
pain,
and disease,
both during and long after their careers are over.
And that's why I smoke pot.
That's why I smoke cannabis.
That's why I smoke weed. That's why I smoked weed when I played.
It has, without a doubt, reduced the amount of pain I live with.
It's my body. I know.
But for some reason, the major North American non-Canadian football league refuses to allow players to use cannabis.
Instead of allowing for safe, natural healing, the sport pushes players towards addictive, narcotic painkillers with serious side effects.
So let's get real, Roger.
Football players should be allowed to use medicinal marijuana.
Without the stigma of it being a banned substance.
Cannabis isn't a drug.
It is a medicine.
Hey, everybody, it's Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Welcome to ACE's Patient Focused Update. Since California became the first state to restore cannabis as medicine in 1996, almost every U.S. state now recognizes some form of cannabis as medicine. But since 1971, the federal government has steadfastly denied the medical benefits of herbal cannabis. Americans for Safe Access is the nation's leading organization fighting for the rights of all patients who use cannabis as medicine. Join us now for another edition of ASA's Patient Focused Update.
We joined Dr. Jehan Marku in Washington, D.C., the Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access, and our discussion on medical cannabis. Welcome to part two of this episode of the Patient Focused Update, the podcast for Americans for Safe Access. I'm Russ Belville, and we're sitting here with Dr. Jehan Marku, the Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access. We were just discussing the 2018 state report cards for the medical marijuana programs graded on a 500-point scale by ASA. Another very promising thing about ACE's report cards there, the grades for all the states, is that there are only four states there, Idaho, South Dakota, Kansas, and Nebraska, that don't receive a grade. They're gray. They're incomplete because they have no program whatsoever. We are seeing some movement. Idaho's House, I understand, has just recently passed another CBD-only type of bill, and there's some movement in some of those other states. Do you think we're going to get one of those last four states anytime soon?
I think that it is inevitable that states will adopt some form of a medical cannabis program. What form they will take, there still seems to be a trend with everyone wants to make orange juice from oranges in their own special way. And I think that what's nice about those states waiting, and if I can talk about the silver lining, I think there's plenty of things to say what's wrong with not implementing a program, is that they can learn from other states and try and develop the program that will be adopted the quickest and be implemented with the right resources. It'd be nice to see these states, you know, these regulators look at this report and think about how can they create, you know, the best program. Based on what other states have been through, like Alabama and Louisiana, Arizona, and these sorts of states where you see big differences in grades.
And speaking of the grades, no state achieved an A rating. The top ratings were B pluses. We got them in six states that got B pluses. California led the way, 89.55%, I think was the number, followed by my state of Oregon. That seems the way it should be, actually, Dr. Marku. I can see California and Oregon leading the way. One criticism I had, though, had to do with patient access and the incredible price that it costs someone to get into the program here in Oregon, something like $200 for the patient fee, $200 for the grower fee, $480 to register for the tracking system. You're up to $1,000 before you get in. Was cost to get in the program, the initial hurdle, a part of the considerations in the grades?
Yes and no. We weren't able to create a metric for assessing, you know, what the per capita cost is. And that is something we have to look at, too, in terms of functionality. And so what's nice is looking at how many people are entering in the program per capita. And when we see, you know, 20, 30,000 patients joining a program over a year or two, those are decent numbers. So I think you're right that is a criteria to take into account in the future. You know, last year, I think when we first did this, it was a 300-point matrix, then a 400-point matrix, and then this year it's a 500-point matrix. And so we're constantly learning as we develop this rubric, more nuances like that. And I think that's a great thing that we should include in our future, in next year's report.
All right. Looking forward to it. Again, it's the state report cards. It's available from the Americans for Safe Access website at safeaccessnow.org. Let's look to the future now, because as we get into springtime, there are a number of conferences taking place, events that people interested in medical cannabis issues should take heed of. And Dr. Marku, what can you tell us? What do we got coming up soon?
Well, I guess going in chronological order, coming up in mid-March, March 20th, ASA will be presenting at the American Chemical Society, basically presenting results, a more detailed presentation about the state of the state's report. And that will be taking place in New Orleans in Louisiana on March 20th. So if you're in Louisiana and you want to, or you're attending the American Chemical Society and their cannabis programming, you can go and see a report about that. And I think that would be worthwhile if you're in the area. We'll also be participating in a cannabis and hemp educational conference put on by the International Pharmacist School in Toronto. That's the 23rd and 24th. Asa will be speaking at that. Coming up in May is our annual Asa conference, and that is May 22nd through the 24th. And this is going to be heavily focused on our End Pain, Not Lives campaign. And this is going to be focused largely on opioids and cannabis, chronic pain and cannabis. And we also organize a day for all the participants of the conference to go and descend upon Capitol Hill and meet with their elected officials. And this is a great conference because we fly out a lot of medical cannabis patients. We train them and educate them to go and talk to their elected officials. And so if you want to come see some international speakers, researchers, policymakers, government officials, and meet medical cannabis patients, it's a great conference in D.C., May 22nd through 24th. And registration is finally open.
All right.
And I'd say coming up in June, even looking further ahead, ASA will also be participating in the International Cannabinoid Research Society meeting at the end of June, and we'll be presenting various information about our certification and training program, as well as the State of the States report.
Mm. All right. Excellent events. And I assume the events are also listed out there at ASA's website?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. And another issue that we brought up in our last discussion, I want to make sure that we cover it this time as well, especially given recent comments by people in the administration on the issue, and that is the crisis of opioid overdose that we're suffering in the United States, with over 60,000 overdose deaths, opioids among those. And ASA is taking a special look at this and trying to educate the public on how medical cannabis can play a role in combating this problem. Give us the latest update on this program from Americans for Safe Access.
So we have a report that is available right now. We'll be updating it for the May conference. But we continue to have events and campaigns to educate people about the latest research. Some of the things we've been seeing is that research from pain clinics over the last 10 years, there's been very little research in this area, but the research has been promising that, in people who are trying to either, abstain or quit using opioid pain medication, that cannabis use is not necessarily associated with relapse. There's a recent report by Powell that came out from the RAND organization, which showed that early adopters of state programs, of medical cannabis programs, are seeing these benefits, but some states are not. And I think for our future report about states' programs, we have to start looking at that. Because states that seem to have very strict programs where it's very hard for patients to enroll, there isn't a good supply, we don't see the opioid, we don't see that drop in opioid deaths that we see in other states. New Jersey, for example, has continued to increase and lead the nation. I think it's three times the average there. And so I think that, those programs in some of these states have not taken root or had enough access or entry, a barrier to entry might be too high in some of these states to see a benefit yet. But I think the trend is overall positive, but we're not seeing the trend universally across states. As we've talked, some states get an F, lots get Ds. And so I think that this gets to our point saying, we have to make this a viable option. And that comes from recognizing chronic pain by creating those protections that allow patients to use cannabis who might be using other prescription drugs.
Yeah, let's get that information out to as many people as possible, especially our elected officials. Many of them are coming around and starting to understand that. We heard some great comments by New York's junior senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who talked about the pharmaceutical companies fearing the competition of medical cannabis for their pain patients. What did you think of that, doctor?
Well, I think you know, it's a good point that the senator made, but I think I don't think the size of the cannabis industry is still a very, very, very small. The entire cannabis industry is still very, very small compared to the pharmaceutical industry. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's one issue of many, I think, that we have to educate people about, because it's not just good enough to have one dispensary in your state, or not to have a variety of products available, or not to have the educational resources available in the state. So I think there is a whole package of things that have to be there for states to see these benefits. And so it's irresponsible just to say, because we have a cannabis program, that we are fighting the opioid epidemic. No, you have to implement it. You have to make sure that there is access. You have to make sure that you're supporting the civil protections for these patients. And the products have to be accurately labeled. If people are trying to use this in a form that needs to be dosed appropriately, accurate labels become more and more important. They don't care about seeing a high percentage of an active ingredient as long as it's accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Let's give people the information again, the name of the project and how they can find out more.
If you go to endpainnotlives.org, you can find out about the campaign and how to get involved, download the free report, and we've been organizing and empowering individuals. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to talk to a Tourette's Society about cannabinoids in treating conditions related to Tourette's and other neurodegenerative disorders, because many people who, you know, a lot of the caregivers for people who are suffering from these conditions are seeing positive results from cannabis in their own anecdotal and objective or observational manner. And I think that there still is an issue of translating the research in an open and having an adult conversation about cannabis and how it's used. I think that people are coming around because they're realizing that medical cannabis products are recommended or prescribed, depending on what country you live in, to treat neurological conditions, not to cause them. And there are public health benefits from having a well-regulated cannabis program with, you know, enough access for the patients.
All right, that's great. And painnotlives.org for more information. Safeaccessnow.org for Americans for Safe Access. Get the state report cards report out there as well. Dr. Jehan Marku, always a tireless advocate for patients and the advocation of medical cannabis science. Thank you so much for making yourself available, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Health Cannabinoid, your ACMPR experts. Consultation services for medical cannabis. Visit healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. That's www.healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. Health Cannabinoid.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Oh, I could have smoked that pot.
Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson, or Norman. And I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is brought to you by Cannabis Kamikaze, a professional licensed producer from Canada producing 3 pounds per light. Follow Cannabis Kamikaze on Twitter at Cannabis Kamikaze. That's at Cannabis, K-A-M-I-K-A-Z, Cannabis Kamikaze.
I have a package here for Radical Rick. Is there a Radical Rick here? How about a Rick Russ? Any Rick Russ? Somebody named Freddie Barak has sent him a package. Anybody? What is that? Sounds like a skunk. It's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation. Call in now at 650-LEGAL-MJ.
All right, welcome back, folks. About that story on Neil Gorsuch in the Supreme Court, I've run out of time. I'm not going to have time to get to that one. I'll save it for the next episode. As we close up shop today, though, I want to give a shout out to Steve Burke out there in Denver, Colorado. And Steve, a longtime friend of the show, you go way back. You may remember he had some parody videos, Should We Legalize, an Eminem parody that he did. He did a Grease parody video. He was out in Miami for a long time, and I actually went and visited him in South Beach and in his condo, a beautiful condo he had there, and did a bunch of artwork and art shows that was very interesting. Ran for mayor down there as well. I think he placed fourth, I think it was. But anyway, lately he went out to Denver, Colorado, and he started this cannabis church. And so it's the International Church of Cannabis. And they had a big celebration on 420 last year. A couple of undercover cops got in. And so now they've had to go to trial, right? So they got to take them to trial for violations of the Indoor Clean Air Act, violations of public use, you know, that's illegal under the legalization law and so forth. It's open and public consumption of marijuana and violating the Clean Air Act, right? Well, this was a private event, invitation only. And it was at the Church of Cannabis, right? So it's going to be interesting because the case could decide what is open and public consumption. Warren Edson, one of the attorneys on the case, has mentioned that they've had cases that decide what is open consumption. They've had cases that decide what is public consumption. But there has yet to be a case that decides what is open and public consumption. So this could be interesting as far as what would be allowed in the future. Well, the update on this case is that a mistrial has been declared because Denver County, they couldn't seat a jury. And we're not talking a 12-person jury like a criminal case. Six. They had to come up with six jurors for this case. They couldn't get them. They called 21 people for the jury. One was dismissed for a medical condition. Two said their stance on marijuana precluded them from upholding the juror's oath. Two said, I can't convict anybody for weed, right? Seven of them were challenged for cause, and four jurors openly questioned the city attorney's theory of the case. And Warren Edson says, I've never seen that. So one member of the jury pool questioned by seven police detectives were on the prosecution's witness list for a misdemeanor marijuana case. Another said that he didn't think tax dollars should be spent prosecuting such cases. Still another prospective juror said she struggled to understand why the city was pursuing the complicity argument when she had witnessed Denver police officers ignore open and public consumption of marijuana in city venues. Quote, have you ever been to Red Rocks? End quote. So there's a mistrial for this case. They waived their right to speedy trial, so they're going to set a new date for a trial on July 11th. And the prosecutor is requesting now 50 people. Bring in 50 people. So see if we can find six people in Colorado who can serve on a jury that has to do with a marijuana case. And this is 15 months after, you know, the event happened. There's been six hearings on this so far, according to Edson. And the maximum penalty in the municipal case they're charging people is $300. They're going to all this trouble and all this money and having to seat another jury and try to pull 50 people in for jury duty over cases that would bust people for a $300 fine.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
Folks, that's all the time we got for this week. Thanks for joining us. Check out the newly redesigned MJAgenda.com with quick icon links to all of our podcast resources. For everyone here at Delta 9 House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.